Bob, you're here for the 38th WHES Crusade for Children. You ever been to Louisville before?
I've been to Louisville several times. In fact, I played a dinner theater here, oh, it's been a dozen years ago, I guess, and I played out at the Coliseum or the Fairgrounds, mm-hmm. I guess it is. I did some one of the first shows I ever did was up here in Louisville with Gene Pitney and Dobie Gray and all of them, Gary Lewis and the Playboys. That was 66, I think it was, 1966.
Bring us up today. What's going on with Bobby Goldsboro today?
Well, I finally took the time. It's taken me 5 years. I thought it would take me a couple of years. It took 5 years to get all my children's stories written and get them in production. I've got the first one was completed, and Disney took it, and it was on this past Easter. It's an Easter special, and it's going to be on again next year on Disney. And
what's it called?
It's called Easter Egg Morning. And I wrote the story, wrote the music for it, did some of the voices, and produced it, and just got to do the whole thing. And it was so much fun. And I have five others in production right now. And
I was going to say, is this what you're into today?
That's
now?
What I'm really into, and I've been. It's been so gratifying to see them finally to happen, you know, because I've had them in the back of my head for so long, and I just and they're so time consuming to do one of these things that especially the animation that takes so long. It takes 6-8 months to do one show, but now that we've gotten one out, and it'll be in all the stores in the video stores this year, and we're going to be have Easter baskets with the plush bunnies and the video cassettes, audio cassettes, books, and everything is being done for next Easter. I have a Christmas one we've done, a new one that's non-seasonal. It'll be out probably in the fall, called Stinger, King of the Bees. And I just love to do these things because I can, after you create these characters and get the story, then you write the music for these situations, and that's what I love to do. So
you create from the word go, I mean,
really?
All the way, the characters
yeah.
and the story. And,
mm-hmm.
stuff,
huh? And that's just, it's so much fun to do it.
So you're doing that more. You're not really pursuing that a pop music career anymore.
Not right now, but now that I've got the things all completed and I can turn them over to the animators, I have time to get back to performing, and so now I'm doing a lot of concert dates, and I'll probably be going back in the studio to record again in the next 3 or 4 months, and because I've also been writing regular songs as well as the children's mm-hmm. songs.
What about your personal life? Wife, family, kids?
I've been married for 7 years, and I have 3 kids, and
what are their ages?
Well, from my first marriage, my son is 26, my daughter 24, and a little girl 16. Little. She's no longer little. My youngest is 16.
Mm-hmm. And you call home?
I live in part of the time in Nashville and part of the time in Central Florida. I'm originally from Florida, from Northwest Florida, Mariana. And so I built a place. My wife is from Daytona Beach, from that area in Ocala. So we built a place down there, so we're there about half the time. Well, I was in a little band called The Webs down in Dothan, Alabama, and as a matter of fact, I was going to Auburn University in my second year of college, and
what year are we talking about now?
This was in 1961, mm-hmm. and our group, The Webs, was hired to back up Roy Orbison for some dates, and we learned all his songs as best 4 guys could, and he liked the way we sounded and that we were not all straight guys, and none of us were doing any drugs or beer and all of this kind of stuff. He had just gotten rid of his band for doing that, so he asked us if we'd like to go on the road as his band, and I never went back to college. I became a member of the Roy Orbison band for 3.5 years.
One of the Candyman?
We evolved into the Candyman. I left before the name was changed to the Candyman. We were just the Roy Orbison band at that time.
How did your solo career begin then?
I wrote a song called See the Funny Little Clown, and it was the 4th song recorded on a session that I cut in New York City. And I was still with Orbison when the record came out. In fact, I'd had a chart record called Molly, but I stayed with Orbison right on through that because I never liked the record. And Funny Little Clown came out and became like an instant hit, and the record company wanted me to go on the road and start doing concerts and things. And I talked it over with Roy, and he said, why don't you give it a try? And if you don't like being a solo artist, you can come back and play guitar for me.
And you did like being a solo artist.
Well, I was really nervous at first. And after the first couple of times I went out and did the shows, I said, I hate this. I had to work with a different band everywhere we went, and the bands didn't know my songs, and they didn't follow me too well, and I didn't have that many songs to do on stage. And I was thinking, boy, if I get through all these things, I'm going back to Orbison. But finally, I did a good concert, and I seemed to like it, so I said, well, I'll stick with it. Butterfly for Bucky is a strange story because I got a poem that was sent to me by a guy who wasn't even in the music business, and he said, I just thought you might want to read this because it's based on a true story. And I read this poem, and it wasn't commercially well written as far as rhyming and all of this, but it was a true story. And when I read it, I got goosebumps because actually what happened, this little boy was born blind. And
it is a true story.
And it is a true story. Mm-hmm. And the doctors couldn't find any reason why he was blind, but he couldn't see. And he always loved to hear about butterflies, and his father would tell him about butterflies. And so they took him to the hospital. Finally, a specialist was going to examine him, and they went through all the tests. And while he was in there, his father went down this little chapel and prayed and said, "Please, Lord, let him help him some way." And this is where I got the goosebumps when I read this line, and it was based on a true story. Supposedly they called his father in there, and they're discussing everything, and he says, "We just really can't find out what the problem is. There's nothing we can do for him." And supposedly, this is what happened. A butterfly flew in the window and landed on the little boy's hand, and the little boy could see the butterfly and starts describing the butterfly, and he could see. And to this day, he can see. Hmm. Now, it had to, I don't know if it was a mental thing or whatever, but he can now see.
Sing a little bit of Voodoo Woman.
You know what? Voodoo Woman was one of the good songs.
Good song.
Thank you. But you know what? It wasn't one of my favorite records, but I knew when I wrote it, I just knew it was a hit record because that little guitar figure at the beginning, I was sitting there watching TV with the guitar in my hand, and I came up with that little guitar lick, and I said, And I started making up crazy lyrics, and a lot of the words, I even made a mistake on the record. There's when it says, "And you bring clouds that cover up the sky." On that particular cut of it, I said, "You boom clouds that cover up the sky." My tongue got twisted, and we got through, and nobody noticed it, and everybody said, "Boy, that's great, that's a smash. We don't need to cut it again," and so I just didn't say anything, you know.
A little voodoo involved indeed.
Yeah, a little voodoo in there.
Can you sing the lead line of "I'm a Drifter"?
"You knew I could not stay for long when you asked me to come over in the wee hours of the morning."
And the story?
The story? I wrote that in Nashville. I remember I had a little apartment up there because I was building my house, and the house wasn't finished so I could move my family up from Alabama. So I was staying in this apartment, and it was one of those times where I would get in a writing mood, and I'd write 3 or 4 songs in a day. And other times I've sat down and nothing happens for 2 or 3 weeks and I can't get an idea. But that was one of the nights that I not only wrote "I'm a Drifter," but I wrote 2 or 3 other things. I can't even remember what they were now. But I really felt that "Drifter" was one of the better songs that I had written. Well,
isn't there a Mac Davis tie-in?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mac Davis wrote this song, and I was in a clothing store in Los Angeles. And I saw a record producer, a friend of mine, Jerry Fuller, was in there. And I went over and started talking to him, and he said, "Do you know Mac Davis?" I said, "Well, I know who he is," because Mac hadn't even started recording at the time. He was just a writer, and I knew who he was as a writer. And he said, "Well, Mac played a song for me the other day to cut with Andy Williams." He was producing Andy Williams at the time, and I said, "I don't think it's a hit. I don't think it's right for Andy, but I think it would be great for Goldsboro. Why don't you play it for him?" He says, "You ought to call Mac Davis and have him play that song." So I went back to the hotel and called Mac, and he came over, and we sat and played songs for about 3 or 4 hours because it was like we were old friends because he was from down around my area, and he knew a lot of guys that I did, and finally he played "Watching Scotty Grow," and I loved it and came back to Nashville and recorded it.
Who's Scotty?
Scotty was Mac's son. I joked with him. I said, "I want to change it to Danny," because Danny was my song, was my son, and he said, "No, you got to keep it Scotty." And the flip side of "Honey" is a song I wrote
Danny.
Called Danny.
Yeah,
so I said, "Well, I've already done one about Danny, so I'll do Scotty this time." I wrote "If You Got a Heart," and with around the little guitar figure, the down 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 da 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 down da da da. And then and the little horn part, bump, 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 bump. And it was one of those kind of things, kind of like Little Things. It had all these little things going on in it. And combined, I thought it made a great record. The thing is, the other side of the record, I thought was a hit, too. And when they said they were going to put them both on the same record, the other side was, I think, "If You Wait for Love," I believe.
Right, huh? In fact, it was a two-sided hit.
They're both going to get play, and you're just going to kill the record. What little bit I knew about the record business, I knew that they were both going to get play. And they said, "Oh, no, nobody will ever hear If You Got a Heart." They liked the ballad side. So when it came out, I think both of them got into the 50s or 60s on the charts, and neither side was a big hit, but they were both hits because they got split play. "The Straight Life" was written by Sonny Curtis, who is a fantastic writer. He's written tons of hit songs, but he was an old friend, and he just would, from time to time, send songs in that he thought would be good for me to record. After he'd write one, he'd say, "This would be good for Elvis. I'll send this to Elvis." He'd write the next one, "I think this would be good for Goldsboro," and he'd send it to me. And "Straight Life" came in, and we liked it, and we went in and cut it. It was just a very simple, and plus, I liked the sound of the record and the feel, and it's probably what every guy that's happily married still thinks about. Hey, you know, he just kind of daydreams about being on an island with the ladies and sipping drinks and just being catered to and all of that. But then he comes back to reality and he's still happy being where he is, you know. I wrote "It's Too Late." I started writing that behind the curtain at American Bandstand. I was out there doing another song on there, and I had the guitar in my hands, and they were had a foul up on the cameras or something. So I was sitting back there for about 15 minutes on the stool, and I got this little guitar figure. And I said, So I started making it up, and I had probably the first verse written when it was time to do my next song, my song on American Bandstand. So I went from there to the airport and flew back to Dothan, Alabama, and it was like a 5.5-hour flight, and I finished the song on the plane going back.
You get inspiration in the middle of the night sometimes. You keep the tape recorder next to your bed, write notes down, that kind of thing.
I should do that, because I guess everybody, even people that don't write songs. My wife recently woke up and said she wrote the greatest song and she can't remember it. I said, well, it probably was no good, because I've done the same thing. You know, and I even dreamed that I have written hit songs and I wrote them on a piece of paper and stuck them over there in a certain place, and I wake up and I go look for it. You know, I think maybe I wrote it in my sleep or something, and it's not there and I can't remember it, but I've rarely written a hit in my sleep, ever.
But you have just about all your hits you did write, didn't you?
Yeah, the majority of them, although the two biggest records I ever had were written by other people. Bobby Russell wrote Honey, and Mac Davis wrote Watching Scotty Grow. Oh, The Letter. That was one. Me and Buddy Bowie wrote that song together. Buddy Bowie ended up producing the Atlanta Rhythm Section and the James Gang and who else? And the Candyman. He did all those. And Stormy and Spooky, he wrote those and produced them. He and I grew up together in Dothan, Alabama, and he road managed Orbison. We had started writing some songs together, and that just happened to be one of them. When I played it for the guy who was producing me at the time, Jack Gold, he loved it, and we went in and did it. And that even had a little recitation in it, you know. But I think I did better on that recitation than I did on Molly.
Speaking of crazy stuff,
how about High Yo Camel? And tell me about that.
Well, that was the follow-up to Cricket in My Ear.
By the Webs.
if you thought Lost was bad, wait till you hear High Yo Camel. But
by the People, P-W-P-L-E.
Yeah, we were going to go out. We were going to change our name to The People. And
from the Webs to the People.
From the Webs to the People. And The People was going to be P-W-E-P-L-E. And we had this whole promotion campaign design, and we were just going to be the hottest thing going. And the Beatles hit. and they did everything that we had planned on doing, except they also were good.
I listened to High Yo Camel, and I think, wait a minute. You even take credit for writing it.
I wish my name wasn't on that. Is there any way to get that taken off?
Do you even know how it goes anymore?
I tried to forget that. We had we had such corny lines on the thing. Again, it was a little thing where we played a little instrumental riff, and then you stop, and we talk. And then you play a little instrumental thing, and we said something else goofy, you know. And they were such bad.
You must have gotten the idea to do that from somebody.
Not really. Well, we got the idea since Lost was such a big hit. Sold 12 copies that I knew of, so I figured, hey, we'll even top that with this one. So we did High Yo Camel, and hopefully that record will stay buried, unless you bring it up.